the time when the oceans drank Atlantis, and the rise of the sons of Arius, there was an age undreamed of. And unto this, destined to bear the jeweled crown of Aquilonia upon a troubled brow, it is I, his chronicler, who alone can tell thee of his saga. Let me tell you of the days of high adventure.
The Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. An hour of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up. Link it up. And take it away. Take it away.
All right. Welcome back to the Linux Link Tech Show.
Episode 101.
Yeah, now I can hear myself. And very special episode 101, because finally all the questions will be answered, because hanging out on Skype right now is Sean Pearson from the Linux Box, who had disappeared for a couple of months, and now he's back. And we're excited that he's still alive. Sean, you're there, right?
Yeah, I'm right here, Dan.
All right, Sean.
So how you guys doing tonight?
Very good. Sean, my first question is, are you one of the 4,400?
What's that?
Are you one of the 4,400?
The 4,400?
What is the 4,400?
You're not familiar with that TV show, either one of you?
Never heard of it.
Basically, the concept was people have been disappearing over history, and they all show up on one day. They come back. They were adopted into the future and given abilities, like telepathic abilities.
No, nothing quite that fascinating.
So what's happening?
Oh, not a whole lot. Ran into a lot of personal problems, and instead of letting the community know, I kind of just withdrew, kind of the wrong approach to take, but, you know, one of those knee-jerk reactions sometimes that we do.
Well, I'm glad you're okay.
But actually, I just started canvassing my local lug. I'm looking to try and restart the show here in a couple months, but probably under a new name, because I'm having too many problems with my web hosting provider, and I just want to try and get like a clean start, and you know, I'll slowly move over all the stuff from my other server.
Well, that's good. I mean, wish you the best of luck, and just glad to know that you're at least you're still alive, like I said. A lot of people were wondering what the heck happened to Sean. And and hopefully you got all that crap put behind you now. Or as much as you can.
Yeah, yeah.
So you are restarting up your local lug, or is the local lug still in existence and still going strong?
Yeah. The local lug is the WP lug. It's based out of CMU. It's pretty strong.
And you're back in there. So you will be back with a new website, new show, and were you looking late fall?
Yeah. It'll definitely be in the fall. I won't stretch it out to winter. I just want to get, you know, maybe a couple more voices on this time instead of having people just listen to me drone on and on.
Hey, you know what? You were doing a great job before, so, you know, it was working.
You know, I always held that you guys had the best show out there. Oh. I think I mentioned that several times on my own show.
Flatter us. Pat's head's already big enough.
We wish the best of luck to you, Sean.
All right.
So what problems have you been having with your web hosting company?
Well, you know what? My web hosting company was bought out by another company. And that was around the time when I was mirroring a movie that got slashdotted. So, like, in one day, my bandwidth shot through, like, 1.4 terabits. And then after that, they were ready to cut my hard disk quota. I have no idea. You know, they completely modified my contract. They suddenly slapped my hard disk quota down to like 250 megabytes, and you know, there's no way you can run a site with 250 megabytes, at least not a podcast site with that small space. So I can't actually upload anything to the show at this point, I mean to the site, so I'll just have to move it over onto another server.
We might have to give you some recommendations for what we use.
Yeah.
Now,
but, go on.
I know a place where you can upload your files. It's called podcastincubator.org.
There you go.
And if you are still interested in doing a show until you can get back on your feet, the same guy, Droops, who does Infonomicon, would, I'm sure, have no problems hosting your files. Because that's what he's doing with podcastincubator.org.
All right, that sounds pretty good.
Just a thought there. Just a thought.
Yep.
Now, when you got slash dotted and your bandwidth shot up through the into 1.4 terabytes, you didn't get charged for that, did you?
No, actually, you know, it was all covered within my contract that I had, but afterwards they abruptly changed my contract.
They said, we got to get some more money out of this guy, huh?
Yeah.
Man, you're lucky, though, that you didn't get...
Oh, I know. That could have cost me a fortune.
On top of it, really sucked.
Yeah. You get like a $4,000 bill from your provider.
Man, I'll tell you what, but you got a lot going on over there, but it's glad to hear from you. And knowing that you're okay. And now everybody else knows, and we're looking forward to that Linux box. Or do you have a new name in mind? Or are you keeping that on your wraps?
I have a name in mind. I'm not ready to announce it yet. You could probably get a good idea from it from the email address I mailed you from the other day. But no, I'm not ready to announce it quite yet.
Ah, okay. I see what you're talking
about. Because, you know, I mean, the site's still kind of being built, and, you know, I don't want people going there and finding dead links going everywhere.
Uh-huh. Now, I don't want to reveal or give it away, but does the name that you're talking about, does that have anything to do with something other than Linux also, like maybe another OS?
Well, you know, it's a little bit, but I don't want to say, you know, that it's like so much of a... it has a little bit to do.
Okay.
Yes. But not.
All right.
Yeah.
I won't bore the people with trying to be esoteric here.
We'll just wait for it.
Yeah, we'll wait for it.
All right,
Sean. I gotta move over to Lincoln Allen, who are on the asterisk side. So I gotta cut you off so I can get over to talking with Saigo and just I'm probably butchering his name again. In just a few minutes. But, you know, really glad to hear from you. And anytime you want to come back on, you know.
All right. All right. Yeah. You know what? Do you guys have any? Email me or give me a link to, and I'll throw in a commercial for you guys right away whenever I start up the new podcast.
Sure.
Like I said, I think you have. All right.
Yeah, we'll send you something.
All right, cool.
I'll get our slaves onto that right now.
All right.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sean. Good to hear from you.
Yeah.
Keep up the
all
good
right.
work, and I'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye, Dan.
Bye.
And that was Sean Parsons.
That was Sean Parsons, back from the dead.
Yeah. He's not one of the 4,400. That would have been cool if he was.
Wow, what was that?
I don't know.
Ah.
Oh, my God. You know what I think that is? I think that's Alan's cell phone cutting out.
I think that's maybe I better shut Skype off.
Yeah, that might be a problem.
Instead of trying to run two different phone devices at the same time on the same computer.
They're both battling for resources as we speak. Oh, man.
Yeah. There we go.
Hey.
Hey, Sweetie Cheeks. Sweetie Cheeks.
I know you're talking to Alan. You got to be.
I wouldn't talk to you like that.
Now you'd say something worse.
That's right.
How you guys doing tonight?
Good. How about you guys?
All right. How's Tim McGraw there, Alan?
I wouldn't know. I'm not in the show.
You drove your wife all the way out to York, Pennsylvania for Tim McGraw. What a nice guy.
Live from York, PA, yes.
I've never been to York.
And Easton.
Your roving reporter here.
Now, you couldn't find a wireless access point out there that's open?
Yeah, I could, but unfortunately I had to take my wife to the show here.
Tell me you're not standing out in the parking lot the whole show.
No, actually I'm sitting on like one of the fairways of the fair here. In front of the rib sandwich booth.
Oh, you're at a... It's another
fair.
Another ferry's plan.
Yeah, I'm stuck at another fair.
Now, for those who don't
know... You say on the ferry?
For those who don't know, Alan's wife went to the same show at the local fair, what, not more than a week and a half ago?
She's a Tim McGraw groupie.
Last week she went.
Last week. Wow.
What's even worse is I've got two more this week to go to. Friday and Saturday in AC today.
At Atlantic City?
Say again?
Did you say Atlantic City?
Yeah, I got to go to Atlantic City on Friday and Saturday night.
At least you can go gamble then.
See the same show once again.
Is that at the House of Blues?
No, I think the Taj Mahal, I think. The place in there. That one's not quite as bad because at least I can go gamble.
Right.
This one here, I can't really do anything. I just like sitting here smoking a cigar and watching people walk by.
Gotta go check out the freaks, Alan.
Are there any hot chicks?
It's an interesting mix of like goth and country and old people.
Did you say goth?
Goth, yeah. G-O-T-H.
All right.
That's not very goth.
Is Bobo the Clown there? No, isn't that the guy? His name Bobo the Clown? Is the clown, the dunking booth clown there? The same one that's at Allentown Fair?
The clown guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's down at the other end.
Is it the same one from
I
the Allentown
Fair? But I didn't really find one.
All right. What do you have to say for yourself, Link?
You're stuck with some of the noise, background noise here, because I have no clue how to mute the microphone on this thing.
Yeah, I know, and you're cutting everybody else out. Like me.
You're going to have to say goodbye to him.
Can you even hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay.
We're going to have to dump you, Alan.
Not much going on here at all.
Whoa, turn down your mic there, Link.
Yeah, Link, you're loud.
You're drowning everybody.
Sure.
Out.
That's better.
How are you doing this weekend, Link?
This reminds me of some other show.
How's the weather?
Doing fine. How about you guys?
Alan's like in the middle of a crowd, and Link's like right up against his air conditioner.
I'm betting it's the same here as it is there.
Hot and sticky?
It's humid as hell here.
Dude, get off my lap.
Well, I'm in a nice quiet spot tonight.
Oh.
Say again?
Not at all.
Alan is just killing his conversation.
I know, Alan. You're killing it. You're killing us. We're going to have to call Sago in just a few minutes. Anything you want to fill us in on, Link, Alan, before we have to cut you off and make that phone call?
Well, I'll tell you, there was some discussion this week on the forums about the eye candy thing going on that I have going on in Fluxbox. You know, I have, like, launchable icons and stuff like that on my desktop. So what I did was I put together real quick, for those who are interested, a little web page that has some links and some explanation of some of the stuff that I use. And you can find that right at our own website. Actually, I put a copy over there. And I'm going to put a link in the IRC chat right now. But what it is, it's tlls.info/reviews/eyecandy. And there's a little webpage there that talks about launchable icons and using things like Roxfiler and iDesk and A-Desklets and things like that. Just to help you get a little bit more functionality out of a light window manager, as opposed to using something big and huge like GNOME or KDE.
Yeah, I took some screenshots of my Fluxbox and Enlightenment DR17. I'm going to also post my Fluxbox configurations, but I'll talk about that later.
Cool.
And, you know, maybe after we talk with Sago, we'll be able to come back and talk some more Fluxbox goodness.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd like to mention something really interesting today, which you guys wouldn't know about because none of you decided to show up to the lug meeting yesterday, which was a really nice...
There was a lug meeting?
Yeah, impromptu discussion on Auk and said by Steve. But anyway, I had an interesting problem at work that occurred in using NetWare 6.5 Service Pack 2 along with OS 10. This has happened with both Panther and Tiger. Apparently, if you're running 6.5 Service Pack 2 or earlier versions of NetWare and you're using native file access using Apple's file protocol, which is what you can use to connect to the NetWare servers using OS 10 and mount NetWare shares, if you attempt to copy a directory that has subdirectories or child files in there, you may be confronted with an error message that says permission, you do not have permission to do this or permission to denied. And what actually happens then is the file is in essence copied but rendered invisible.
The number you have dialed is not in service. Please check the number and try your call again.
Who's that?
Thank you, and try again.
Well, anyway, it renders it invisible at the same time as being inaccessible, but the file is actually there. You cannot see it in OS X, in Linux, in Windows, in DOS, anything. But if you actually try and change directory into that directory, you will do it. You'll be able to get in there. If there's files in there or other subdirectories, you will not see them. But you can change directory into there. You can run the file command on the file or directory. It will report back what exactly that file or directory is, that file type. The bigger problem is you cannot delete these files. It will not allow you to delete them in any operating system. Even Novell's own file system tools will not allow you to delete the files. They don't show up in any of Novell's file system tools, like I said, but they are there. If you attempt to do like an rm-rf on the parent directory, it will not let you delete it because it says that the parent directory is not empty. You go in there and it will not let you delete any of those subdirectories or files because in S they are not there to the operating system, but they do exist. Well, Novell has fixed this in the AFP TCP NLM that was released post-Service Pack 2. They have fixed the problem with copying nested files and directories. But what they haven't fixed yet in Service Pack 2 is the ability to delete these files once they have been created. There is a tit out there, if you go hunting for it, that says that this is merely a cosmetic issue. It's far more than a cosmetic issue because if you need to create that directory or the contents of that directory, you will not be able to do that in the same location because you will be prevented from copying over an existing file that is not really there. They do also say in the TID that if you want to fix this problem, you have to call Novell support for a specific module, and they have them walk steps or procedures to actually delete these files. The unfortunate side to this is Novell will not talk to you about this without $325 up front, unless you have a support contract with them. So I managed to muster up $325 out of Pat's pocket. No, actually, I got a PO cut to call them up, and I'm hoping that once this is all said and done, I'll be able to get my money back because this is a Novell bug, not something that we, did on our own. Anyway, support, and of course, the people were really nice. It was great because I can understand exactly what they were saying. Problems or dialect problems were helpful. Unfortunately, the gentleman was not able to assist me with the problem. He had to escalate that up the chain of command there, and I'm still waiting back from them to hopefully get this file for a fix. I suspect after digging around on their support website, I know exactly what needs to be done. I just need the right file to do it. Unfortunately, I'm having trouble getting it, and it may cost $325. So their support is, well, it's pretty good. Thumbs down that I have to pay for something I did not cause up front. But I thought I'd pass that along. If you are running OS X or Mac systems in a NetWare environment and you are not running Service Pack 3, I think might Service Pack 3 or Fix 5, be very careful of that problem with copying nested directories and child files. That's my tip for the day, or warning.
Rock on, Dan.
Rock on.
Yeah, what he said.
So what we are
whatever
going...
he said, yeah.
Yes. Gentlemen, you are going to have to switch to your favorite media client, which means we'll be kissing Alan goodbye. So we can call Sago, who is the lead developer on KDE Plasma, version 4.0 of KDE. Am I right, Pat?
He's, yeah, there's the new next generation KDEs called Plasma. They're working towards 4.0.
And we're very excited to have him on and to talk about this. I've been to their website. It looks fascinating. So I have to cut you off so I can make this phone call. All right? Any last words?
Hey, no problem. We'll see you all guys next week.
Beautiful.
Nice.
Thanks. So I'll
be around. You guys just let me know, and then you can conference me back in.
Okay, KKKK.
No problem.
All right, we'll call you back in a few minutes.
KKK, yeah.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. Good night, all.
Wonder if I can dial this phone number.
Let's try Aaron.
I gotta, like, mangle the phone number. Nah, there's no way they'll pick up what that phone number is because I've dialed it and deleted and dialed. Is that the right phone number? All right, here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, I better take it off of mute. That would be good.
Yeah, that'd be a good thing.
Hello?
Hello, Sago.
Yes.
Is it Saigo or Asiego? How is it pronounced? Saigo. Okay.
Yeah.
I apologize for butchering it. Yeah, I apologize for butchering your name.
You would not be the first nor the last.
I feel your pain.
So you are the lead developer on KDE's Plasma.
That's correct, yes. Yeah, I'm the person who gets the wonderful job of kind of trying to hold the whole thing together, that project, and herd the cats and move people forward. And it's really been quite an interesting process, if only because it didn't start out as, you know, a new project. We're starting out from scratch, and let's see what we can do with this and, you know, dream big and code hard. We're obviously starting from a known quantity, which was the desktop of KDE, K-Desktop, Kicker as well. But we also looked around, and when I was thinking about, you know, what would a modern desktop look like and what would a modern desktop work like, and one of the things that occurred to me was, you know, the desktop, we just throw icons there. And we do so much more than have, you know, 20 or 30 icons on our computer at a time. Back when the Mac came out, right, we used, what, floppy disks. And the floppy at that time held, you know, a dozen or so files. And that was all you had to deal with. So throwing the icons on your desktop made, like, all the sense in the world. But we've kind of come a long ways since then, hopefully anyways. And we use, you know, our computers for all sorts of things, from instant messaging to, you know, browsing the web, which didn't exist back then, to working on projects and doing whole project management on our systems. And so thinking about how that had changed the way we use computers, I realized the desktop hadn't kept up. And one of the things I wanted to do was kind of get rid of the concept that the desktop was just for icons. And looking around, it's actually kind of funny that you link that that section on iCandy. Because when I looked around, I thought, you know, what would be really great is having the ability to put fully functional widgets and creating almost full interfaces with your desktop. And so we looked around, and there was Supercromba. So we've kind of pulled in that project as well. So we've started with a bunch of projects with a bunch of development teams and a bunch of code bases and kind of surveying the successes and weaknesses of all of them and kind of charting forward. So, yeah, it's been, even thus far, it's been something of a challenge.
So you guys are shooting for the 4.0 release of KDE, right?
That's correct, yeah.
And for 3.5, what are you guys doing? Cleaning up code, getting everything consolidated?
For 3.5? No, it's a bit more than that. It's also a feature release. If you look at programs like Copete, the Instant Messenger and KDE, they've added quite a few features, including, ironically enough, given our issues tonight with Skype, a Skype plugin. The Contact, the Personal Information Manager, has added numerous features, and they've cleaned up the interface quite a bit as well in 3.5. Kicker the Panels has gained a number of features in 3.5 and had some usability things, issues addressed. Conqueror, the web browser, it renders a lot of sites better, passes ACID 2, etc. So it's more than just a polish, although that's been a large part of it. It's also a full-fledged feature release.
Well, one of the things about KDE is that it is so loaded with all different applications. How do you guys pick and choose what is part of the official release and what is an add-on application?
Sorry, you're breaking up there, but just if I could repeat the question to you, you asked how do we decide what's in a release?
Yeah, what's part of the main code base and what's considered an extra add-on application?
Okay. Well, to date, when KDE first started out, the mandate was we want to create a desktop and have every application that a user would rationally expect to have on their computer already installed to be able to do day-to-day work. Which at the time when it started, that meant what, a text editor and a control center and a file manager and an email application. And over time, that body of applications has grown and grown and grown. Generally, what we've tried to do, and sometimes not completely successfully, is try to say, okay, if we're going to include this application with KDE proper, is it actually going to be used by a large segment of the user base? Is this something that people would really expect to be installed when they walked up to a computer that was ready, you know, fully loaded for them to actually do whatever a person does with computers these days? And, you know, as I said, sometimes we didn't quite get there. And there were applications that, you know, were perhaps missing or shouldn't have been in there or what have you. And that actually led to a lot of discussion this year at Academy, our world conference, which is held in Spain just last month, actually, about how we actually handle the stewardship of what happens in KDE releases. And whilst in the past we've done it a lot more of a community-oriented kind of thing, where we discuss it as a large group of people and, you know, him and haw and go, well, should that go in, should that not go in, should it be an extra gear, which is our kind of our collection of applications that we want to support the development of with our translation teams and our bug finding teams and whatnot, but doesn't really belong in an actual release of KDE. You know, does it belong in KDE extra gear, or where does it go? And we're actually going to be putting in processes in place and groups of people that are going to be kind of helping manage that effort of actually making the decisions of, well, does this actually belong in a release? Where does it belong in the release? And helping us actually come to logical conclusions with this. So that's actually something that's going to be new with KDE 4, is a lot more of a healthy process that goes along with how do we actually define the desktop.
I mean, it sounds like it's a real challenge, because just for the simple fact that the project has grown so much over the past few years.
Yeah, I mean, these are problems of success, you know. I mean, if we were, you know, a project that was failing, we wouldn't have these problems. But with growth and with, you know, the success of appealing to a large number of people that want to write software for the desktop, yeah, we run into issues that, you know, we could only dream of at one point in time. So, yeah, it requires that we adapt and, you know, in some ways change some of the things, way we do some things. But at the heart of it remains, you know, and still remains an open project where people come and they get involved and whatnot. But yeah, definitely, these are relatively new issues, but ones I'm glad we have.
Now, to take a step back a second, had mentioned about Super Caramba. Is that the name of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, from Super Caramba, that concept, we have springing Dashboard from OS X, and.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's a push, but I've never used Super Caramba because I don't have a Windows machine, and I never went and tried it on OS X. But I have seen Dashboard, and I've used Dashboard, and after using it, I've promptly shut it off because it seems like, particularly with Dashboard, it's separate from the desktop. It doesn't exist on the desktop. It's actually almost like you bring it up, it takes over your desktop. When you're done with whatever you wanted to use, it goes down again. Are people really clamoring for these kind of little mini applications, so to speak, applets? I mean, is this something that's, do you think, is more than just like, hey, that's cool to have a stock ticker on my desktop, but eventually I'm going to get sick of seeing it there? I mean, you think it goes?
Well, I think you're right. To be frank and honest, Dashboard, like many things that Apple has come out with in the last 5 years, are really cool hacks, but pretty much pointless. And oftentimes bordering on the point of being completely unusable, which is ironic given their track record in the 90s and 80s. I used to develop and use Macs a lot in the 80s and 90s, develop on them, I should say. And, yeah, I loved it back then. A lot of what they've done recently has been cool. I don't know if I would agree with all of their UI decisions, and Dashboard is one of those things. It's cool. But how long do you keep it there before you go, okay, this is consuming resources that I don't really need, and does it serve any practical value? I wasn't sure from your description of Super Caramba there if you had the impression that it ran on Windows, but it actually runs, it's a KDE application, so it runs on KDE. And one of the challenges that these programs have is, you know, with Dashboard, they put on another layer because it doesn't really interact with the desktop. And Super Caramba does interact with the desktop, but it does so using some fairly clever but not very performant techniques to appear like it's, you know, merging with your desktop and, you know, these nice alpha-blended transparencies and whatnot. And it's remarkably inefficient in the way it's done, and that's not so much because of the Super Caramba team, but just because we've never exposed a proper interface to build these kinds of applets with. Do people use applets? Well, I think if you have a stock ticker, there's a lot of people that do use those, but is that a broadly applicable thing? I don't know. Everyone I know, with a few exceptions, uses a taskbar when they use Windows or Mac OS, use the dock, or they use KDE or they use GNOME. Virtually everybody that uses a full desktop uses a taskbar. And at the end of the day, the taskbar is an applet. Now, what makes that applet successful? What makes it something that everybody wants and keeps? And that's because it's useful, to be blunt and honest. It's something that gives you access to windows you can't see. So I think the question's not, well, are applets popular? Are they, you know, are they successful? Are people asking for them? Well, we've been using them, and some people use them, a lot of people use them every single day, all day, for years. The question is, what do we do with the applets? If they're just there to provide eye candy, you're right. No. We're going to appeal to, you know, 3 or 4% of the users and, you know, the general population base, and it's not going to be a huge thing. But if we produce applets that actually have an effect on the way we work, which is something that we just don't use our panels and our desktop for in general right now, they don't aid and abet our work. In fact, usually they get in the way of our work, and that needs to change. Project management and workflow, for instance, is just a simple example. Someone posted an email to the appeal list, which is another KDE-related project that I'm involved with, and they laid out this really obvious, and it was kind of comical when you step through it, workflow. You know, he says, okay, I grab an image off the web, then I save it to a disk, then I open it in GIMP and I change it because I'm going to put it somewhere else, then I save that as a different name, then I go and I use it, I open up Quanta, to edit my website, and I use that new image in my website. Then I upload it. Now, when I'm done, I go back to the image that I did in GIMP, and I delete it. Then if I'm really smart, I go back and delete the original image, and I'm done. And he says, and I have to open it up in like 4 or 5, he actually stepped through it. There's 4 or 5 open and save dialogues. There's all these locations he had to remember. And that's nuts. Who wants to do that? Why can't we just say, grab this image, throw it here, have a little place you can just plop it, and then when you're ready to grab it again, drag it from there and over into the other application, and you don't have locations, per se, that you're throwing things physically, you know, in a hierarchy on your disk. You're not hiding them through file, open, and save dialogs. You're actually using spaces on your desktop, on your panels, to create and coalesce projects. I think those are the kinds of applets and the kind of areas we have to explore more. because these are the areas where the desktop is really, really draggy, in the sense that it makes people do a lot more work than they should, and it makes people a lot less efficient than they ought to be given the computing we have.
I guess, so I
think it's really what we do with Netflix.
I guess the risk is you don't want to become the weather bug of Linux with these little desktop applets. Something that's, you know, sucks up, you know, resources and really doesn't do much for you.
Yeah. Again, you're cutting out a bit, but you said you don't want it to be something that just sucks resources. And yeah, I mean, one of the things that we're working on really hard, assuming that was your question, is doing things in a way that's efficient and actually performant. And it's interesting because for the first time, really, traditionally the desktop, open source desktop, has been kind of its own little world, and we really haven't done a lot with a lot of other people. And recently, in the last couple of years, we started to dip down into the kernel layer and working with people that are, you know, doing things like HAL, the hardware abstraction layer that allows us, you know, you plug a USB key in versus a camera. We can tell the difference, and we know when you plug it in, we can pop something up on the screen. That's been a change. But we're also starting to work at with the X.org project. TrollTech has got a few of their people working pretty intimately with them, Zach Rushin being one of them, Lars Noll being another. And they're doing immensely great work. So we're improving the lower layers, like X. And this has gotten the interest, now that we have an application as well that might push what we need out of a graphics card, we've been talking with people like ATI and NVIDIA. And we didn't approach them. They approached us and said, okay, hey, wait, if you guys are actually going to start using, you know, possibly, you know, our graphics cards for real and applications on Linux beyond, you know, people that are doing image processing and visualization, can you let us know, like, what you're using and how you're using it? Can you send us X traces so we can actually optimize and, you know, ensure that our drivers, you know, are ready for this and work as well as possible with the kind of stuff you're doing? So we're doing a lot of low-level work than we have traditionally to prepare the kind of effects and the kind of graphics that we're actually going to be using. And then we've got some really cool stuff happening around SVG. That's going to be, you'll probably be hearing about it in the next few weeks. Again, working with TrollTech and at the Qt layer and, you know, using SVG, a lightweight version of SVG, to efficiently power things like animations and whatnot without taking up a huge amount of CPU cycles. So I think it's a really exciting time in that we can actually provide these kinds of items and we can take the time to do it right. We're not under the financial burden and obligation that, say, a closed source company is to push it out no matter what it looks like. And we're working at a bunch of different layers now from the hardware on up that we haven't traditionally. So I think we stand a good chance of moving the whole, this is really cool looking, but God, I need a huge system to run it. I think we stand a very good chance of actually making everything run at the highest eye candy levels on rather moderate resources.
Let me just correct something here, and I apologize.
Sure.
I meant Confabulator before, not Super Caramba. My mistake. Got that mixed up. Confabulator was the little applet
right. Application
that
yes.
that led into, I think, influenced Apple's dashboard.
I think they stole it from them.
Right. Second thing, bringing up a whole lot of different things. Again, I want to step back to what you were talking about before with being able to take an image and use it in all these applications without having to save it from one application, open it in another, save it, and then open it and this and that. Now, in KDE is largely built upon Qt, TrollTech's Qt, right? How
that's correct. Yeah.
How is that type of interaction or usability across applications or integration with other applications? How is that going to work with non-Qt based applications like stuff that's based on GTK or other widget sets? You know, like the GIMP, like you brought up a good example of the GIMP. Is that going to be seamless?
Have you ever opened up Conqueror and the GIMP? I hate GDK's file dialog. It gives me headaches. So this is how I use the GIMP. I actually open up a Conqueror window. I navigate to where I want to go, and then I drag and drop the file from Conqueror to get the GIMP, and it opens up.
Conqueror is an excellent file management system. I use KDE regularly. And Conqueror is fantastic. It's a file manager that really has improved immensely.
Yeah, I agree. And so, yeah, it's my file manager for GIMP. We've already kind of licked the problems of, well, can we do interoperability at the drag-and-drop level? If we were to talk about it from the technical perspective, what would happen is that when you're dragging these objects to and from, say, a project space, what would actually happen is it would be saved to disk, right? We would store it. It's not going to stay in RAM. And we would actually have a physical location on disk. Then when you drag it out, we'd actually send the URL for that file with the drag object. So what's really happening is the same thing that's always ever happened. We're able to present it in more flexible and creative ways to the user, and that's what matters.
Okay. Now.
And yeah, that'll work with anything that supports X drag and drop.
X drag and drop. Mm-hmm. Now.
Go to the freedesktop.org spec.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
So. Now, taking the reverse, of course, KD. How is this going to impact on other window managers? Like, for instance, I use Enlightenment or Fluxbox. If I actually fire up a KDE application when version 4 is released, is it going to start taking over that current window manager and trying to implement a lot of this extra usability and integration? Because I know in some instances, if you bring up a GNOME app, it'll fire up Nautilus behind the background.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we did as well at Academy this year was we sat back and we said, okay, let's sort out what is KDE. And this is important from many people's perspective, one being the users, like exactly what you just laid out. It's also important for ISVs. It's important for people that are trying to package what we create. It's also important for people who would like to run these applications on OS X or Windows. So we did a lot of work in kind of restructuring how our libraries and KDE libs are going to be laid out. And one of the other things we did is we said, okay, what are the rules for applications? And there's actually a blog by Daniel Kenton that has a really nice little image on it that shows this. While I'm talking, I'm going to see if I can find it. Let's see how well I multitask here. But what we said was there's going to be basically three large layers, if you will, of applications. There's going to be the base apps, there's going to be workspace, and there's going to be everything else. And the base applications, actually, it's easier to describe from workspace first. Workspace are going to be all the applications that you see in the KDE desktop shell, which is Plasma, KWin, KControl, the control center, or well, whatever replaces it, and a few other applications like that. The base apps are all the applications that are portable, which means that you may want to use them and or should be usable on other platforms, that Workspace would require. So you need a file manager, you need a web browser, you need a help center, you need all these other things. Those are base apps. And everything else is above that. So we're not going to tie Copete, for instance, to Plasma. We're not going to tie Conqueror up into the file manager in KDE4 up into the workspace. That's its own little world. We can provide all of the integration and all of those things from the workspace out to the applications without requiring a reverse dependency. So, and that's really what we're aiming for. I mean, yeah, we've one of the things again that we're really looking at strongly in KDE4 is portability. So not just to, you know, Linux as well, but other platforms. And I found it. Look at that. I can multitask. Haha. Let me just grab the link. I'm going to throw it into the channel here, and I guess you guys can put it up on the website whenever, if you deem it of quality.
Sure.
There it is.
So how big was the conference in Spain? How many people were actually there?
We had in excess of 200 people every day registered. So it was a fairly decent size.
And this is all people involved in the project?
The vast majority, yes. Yeah, we did have some people from the community. The people from Linux Malaga did a tremendous job of coordinating and, you know, really putting in the extra mile. So there was people from the area there. There are also some people from business in the area and whatnot. But the majority of people, especially once the speaking tracks were done and it was just into, you know, hardcore hackerdom, then it was almost exclusively KDE hackers or KDE-related hackers at that point.
One of the questions that's on the IRC chat room here is, do you guys have a timeline of when KDE 4 is going to be released?
We haven't set down a final, you know, date for that yet. We're still in the planning stages of what is our exact timeline going to be. In KDE, we've taken the approach traditionally that we try to set out goals for ourselves and we go, okay, what is a reasonable timeline for these goals? And then we set out, you know, milestones for ourselves and then usually meet them within a few weeks of our deadline. And we haven't been able to do that yet because we're still formulating, okay, what are our final goals for KDE4? What does the initial port from Qt3 to Qt4 actually look like and how does that work? So we're still resolving some of the issues that we need to before we can actually lay down a concrete timeline. But if I was to kind of, you know, shoot from the hip, and based on what I've kind of talked with this other people as well and what I've read and heard, we're aiming for around fall of next year.
Now, is that going to have wobbly windows?
I'm sorry, what was that about windows?
Is it going to have wobbly windows?
Wobbly windows. What would you use them for?
To watch them.
And I asked that because that's kind of useless, right? I mean, I don't know if you caught Zach Rusin's Beauty and Magic for KDE presentation. It's actually online. He's got a window manager and composite manager that does the wobbly windows and the cube, you know, with XPL, all these really, you know, neat little things. And we were sitting there and talking about it, and he was at a moment of despair. He said, you know, Aaron, I can do all these cool things, but none of them are usable, and none of them actually do anything useful. What can we do with this stuff that would actually be useful? You know, I mean, he says, I don't want to just make something that is cool but useless. And wobbly windows largely is kind of one of those things. It's a technology preview, right? It says, hey, we can do this. But the next step is to say, okay, now that we've got these cool toys, how do we turn them into tools? And what can we actually do with them? So we actually did quite a bit of brainstorming around that at Academy as well, and I think we came up with some interesting ideas. And I'm sure you'll be seeing mock-ups as they come out and actual things to play with that you can download if you've got Qt4 in the next month or three.
All right. So KDE is probably it's constantly winning the top of the line for user desktop, top spots. Most, quote, newbies really like KDE, and seasoned users really like KDE.
I would agree to that.
I use KDE. I like it.
But there seems to have been a shift with a lot of the newer distributions coming out today are moving towards GNOME. Like SUSE used to be a big KDE distribution, but now it has kind of moved a little in the direction of GNOME with Novell purchasing them and Zimian. And, you know, you have
right.
Ubuntu. Slackware has targeted KDE. Do you think that you're going to start seeing a shift again with people flocking more and distributions more coming back to KDE? Or are you? Do you think that's going to happen?
That's a hard one to say. I mean, predicting those kinds of things is kind of like spinning the bottle, right? You hope it lands with a pretty girl, but you never know.
Right.
If you look at it, I think what happened was largely, you know, a reaction to a market where suddenly the desktop got a lot more interest and a lot more people were looking at it, and so a lot more investment went into it, a lot more people were trying things with the desktop on Linux. And I think that's a good thing. And what that meant was that people were starting to diversify and take, you know, more risks and trying different things and whatnot. With SUSE, definitely when they were brought in under the Novell umbrella, And, you know, they obviously had the Zimian people already inside, which, you know, goes without saying they're pretty big Gnome fans. you know, that definitely put more of an emphasis on Gnome within their camp. But, I mean, they're still huge KDE supporters, and they still, you know, employ a large number of very important KDE people that do a lot of great work and continue to hire, in fact, in that direction. And, I mean, they've done things like group-wise support in Copete, group-wise support in Contact, doing the KDE integration of OpenOffice. So, I mean, those are good signs. You know, Ubuntu, I think, is a great project. I'm actually using it in a few projects myself, although I'm using the Kubuntu derivative of it, which is part of the main Ubuntu project now, which, of course, is Ubuntu with KDE. So, I mean, I don't know if we're seeing a you know, quote-unquote, return to KDE, but I definitely think what's happening is that the entire pie is growing, and we need to keep it growing. And less important than how many distributions are using KDE and how many are using GNOME, it's how many users are using an open-source desktop, and how many of those people are using KDE, and how many of those people are using GNOME, and how can we make that group of open-source desktop users grow? We've got, you know, depending on who you ask, 1 to 4 or 5% of the desktop. You ask the right analyst, he'll say, oh, yes, we have more than the Macintosh now, right? You ask the wrong analyst, and he'll say, well, you've got practically nothing. So if we, you know, average it out somewhere between, we say we've got 2.5% of the desktop. You do the math, that's 97.5% of the desktop that is out there for us. And that's really where I have my eyes. I think a lot of us tend to myopically look at our own little navel and go, well, what are our own distributions doing, and how are they going, and, you know, what are the 10 users that in my area that, you know, what are they using? And from within the project, I think that's fine, I guess, if you know, you're a user and you're on that side. But within the project, we really have to keep our eyes at the broader picture and go, okay, we have, you know, 90%+ of this market to address, and how do we do that effectively? And for me, that's the much more interesting question.
So then, in your opinion, because this is always batted around, is Linux ready for the common user desktop, the general user desktop?
There is no such thing. I mean, you've got people that do Office and web. My mom, yeah, Linux would actually do her a lot better. I hadn't seen her, I hadn't been to her house in 6 years, no, more than that, 8 years, when I went and visited last year. And walked in, and there's her computer, and she fired up. She said, my computer's a little slow. And she fires up Internet Explorer, of course, and half the screen was toolbars of every single imaginable thing, and riddled with spyware and whatnot. For her, Linux is more than ready. It does, it, you know, edits her spreadsheets and her Word documents, and it does her web banking, and it does, you know, email and instant messaging. And for her, it's perfect. You'll find people that it's not perfect for. A gamer, for instance. We're getting there, we're not there yet. For people that have invested heavily, and I would personally say a little bit foolishly, in tools that are only available on a platform, whether that, doesn't matter what platform that is, whether it's a traditional Unix platform or a Windows, Microsoft Windows or Mac, they've locked themselves in. And that's, you know, until we find ways to free up those applications, either by making them not need them anymore at all, that functionality, or by replacing them with something better, or by making those applications cross-platform, those are going to be people hard to reach. What is happening, though, is with every release that we do, we cover more and more and more of what people need to do with the desktop and what they expect from a desktop computer. So with every release, we're covering more. So for some people, it's been ready for a few years. For some people, it's been ready this year. And for even more people, it's going to be ready next year. And it's just a matter of, you know, how much percentage falls in each of those categories.
Now, is your mom using Linux now and KDE, or is she still on Windows?
Yeah, no, she's still with Windows. Humorously enough, she saw my laptop and saw everything I did, and she said, "I never had the spyware problem." I said, "No, you wouldn't. you don't see these problems on Linux." And she's like, "Wow, so can you install this, you know, for me while I'm here?" And I said, "Well," and this was last January, and I said, "Well, do you know anybody in the area that could, you know, when you have problems, can support?" She lives quite a ways away from me, so I said, "Is there anyone in the area that, you know, could, you know, hold your hand and walk you through things?" because he occasionally runs into problems and there's someone in the neighborhood that helps her out. And she said no. And I said, well, I'm not going to leave you with Linux on your desktop with nobody to support you, because then you'll hate me and you'll hate Linux, and I don't want either of those things to happen. And in her area, there's not a whole lot of Linux people. She just lives in an area where it hasn't really hit yet, just starting to. And that's really something that we really need to address, especially in North America, we need to address, is the talent pool at the lower levels. And we've got some amazingly great hackers on this continent that are doing just amazing things at every level of the technology stack, from hardware all the way up to, you know, top-level desktop software. But where we need to do a lot of work, I think, is people in the trenches. And that's where that's one of the reasons why I've started the open source desktop workshops, OSDW, is to address one segment of that in the trenches, which is the developers who write these vertical applications that lock people into platforms. It's getting the skills and the knowledge of how to develop software. And we also need to do that for people who know how to administer it and how to support other people in their neighborhood. And that will happen as well naturally as we grow our market worldwide, but as well as in North America. We'll get more people. You know, eventually there'll be someone in my mom's neighborhood who uses Linux and knows how to run a computer. And at that point, you know, we can throw it on her computer, and I can sleep well at night knowing she'll be taken care of.
You know, I've run into that too. And I mean, all my neighbors here, and I say they come to me with problems because their machines are riddled with spyware. And of course, you got to do the old reformat and throw in the system restore disk. And I've often thought, man, you should carry them over to Linux. But it's always like one or two things that just throw up a huge roadblock. If it's not their internet service provider, it doesn't provide capability for, like, they might be on, People PC is one of them, I think, around here, or AOL that they're using. You know, and then on top of that, they're like, well, I like to use Yahoo Messenger and do the audio and video chat back and forth, or I want to run my online poker games, or I want to, you know, it's like one or two things that they do on their machine that had just not, do not have the capability of doing in Linux yet. And of just exactly what you were saying, those few applications that are platform specific and lock them down. And it cripples.
Yeah. And that's why I'm kind of excited about Qt 4. I mean, I had written that infamous blog about, you know, we have to be careful in KDE not to port absolutely everything over to Windows. The message, besides getting put out to an audience I never intended it to, namely Slashdot, it also, I think, got wildly misunderstood. I'm really excited that Qt 4 is GPL on Windows. What this allows us to do is reach a whole new audience of developers on Windows. Now they've got a toolkit that is tier one on Windows. I mean, it is top notch. You write an application using TrollText Qt on Windows, and it looks great, it works great. There's no second-class citizenry attached to that. Because it's GPL, they can write open-source software for Windows using it, learn how to use it. And this software is innately, as long as they don't tie it to Windows using some other bit of Windows, as long as they stay around, you know, Qt, it's innately portable to our platforms. And within the development community, we really, really need to, and not our development community, we already understand this. We understand portability because we've borne the wrong end of that stick for a long time. But it's the general software developers community that we really need to get into their head that, you know what, cross-platform is important. It's something you can sell to your clients as a benefit. It's something that future-proofs you. It's something that gives you more skills. It's something that gives you more options, and it's just the right thing to do. We also, you know, need to get more people demanding that and not being happy. And I think it's you know, starting to happen. People look over that fence and go, I would love to be able to use, you know, Linux with, you know, whether it's low cost or higher security or whatever it is for them that does it for them, or, you know, I love Amarok. God, I want Amarok. You know, whatever it is that makes them want to switch, and then they turn around and go, but there's this one application that's holding me back, and that person is doing me a disservice. you know, or this one company is doing me a disservice. And that whole concept that you know users are empowered and they can actually turn around and complain, you know, that's something that we need to, as well as we start to get more market influence, that we need to, I think, anyways, to kind of percolate out. What are the kind of problems you folks run into? I don't know if I'm supposed to ask questions, but I'm going to do it anyways.
What problems we run into with regards to getting users over onto an open platform?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking, specific problems? I work in a school district, and the primary problem that I have in trying to introduce something like Linux or move over to Linux on the desktop is the sheer number of educational applications that they use, both in the younger grades and the higher grades. Like, you could take an application like OpenOffice and get close to convincing them to use OpenOffice in conjunction or in addition to Microsoft's Office, but then there's a whole host of other applications like the Jumpstarts, the Broderbund titles, a whole bunch of Scholastic software that's just not available yet in a portable cross-platform application. Some of them is moving to the web and moving to Flash, but there's a whole host of those applications that they use, and they get catalogs every week in the mail filled with educational applications, and none of those will run on Linux, and some of them won't even run on OS X. So that's one big hurdle right there, educational applications. Games, which you brought up before, is a big hurdle. And then just the amount of effort and skirting the line of legality with codecs, video codecs, some audio codecs, being able to watch online movies, or even a DVD, being able to play a DVD. Technically, they'd like to say that that's not legal for you to do in the United States, or I don't know if it's legal up in Canada, to be able to possess the software to do that on Linux without paying for it or paying. I don't even know where you'd purchase something like that other than through Linspire, legally.
Well, that's actually last thing is slowly changing. I'm hearing of more and more groups that are actually going to be paying the fees necessary to be able to distribute those libraries. That's going to slowly become less and less of an issue. I would still love to see open source codecs, but we have to work with realities sometimes. And the more we can support, the open source versions, the OGs, the Fioras and whatnot, the better. But yeah, how do we, rent a DVD and watch it? That's important. There's more in the works than just Linspire. I think Linspire showed that it was possible and that it was doable to a lot of other people. So in the next year, as long as things are going the way they're going, you can expect to hear of more places where you can get this without paying an extra fee on top of, whatever. So that's the good news there. Educational applications, completely agree. There's a fellow out in Hawaii, Scott Belford, who puts on the Trans-Pacific Open Source Conference every year in January. And he's deeply involved with education out there and actually rolls out terminal server classroom sets to schools that need them out there through his HOSEF, Hawaii Open Source Education Foundation. Amazing man, doing great work. And we were actually just talking about this, in August. One of the things he talked about was this software called ESIS, which is this information management system. And, they were trying to roll it out, and it's been kind of difficult, and it runs really well on Linux. they were trying to run on the Mac, doesn't work so well, runs great on Linux. And that was kind of a funny story. So, that's fully changing as well, I think. People are realizing that the openness is a requirement. Now, the ISV market is different. We do have the KDE Edu project, which is creating more and more high-quality educational software, but there's only so much that they can do as well. We need to get more people writing that kind of software. But we also need, to really, find a way to latch on to the ISV market and convince them, hey, what we need to do is, we need to have your software being cross-platform. And the one thing that speaks to ISVs, volume. If you give them volume, if you give them somebody to sell things to, you know, they will start to shift what they're doing, which is why I look at what Scott's doing and what's happening in Indiana right now with their pilot program there. And I look at that and go, okay, please, the rest of the school systems around, you know, in North America and elsewhere in the world, look at this. Look at these people. They're doing brave things. They're taking the first steps, not waiting for other pieces of software to emerge. They're doing it, just going out and doing it and making it work, oftentimes because they have no other options, really, but they're doing it and making it work. And once we hit a certain level, a certain volume, then the ISV problem just goes away. Because then they look at it and go, oh, okay, so if I actually use cross-platform tools and I, you know, have a few people on staff to actually make sure that, you know, it runs on Linux, and we have a few people that are doing, you know, manning the help desk that, you know these issues, and I can make money doing that, at that point it'll happen. So, I think that what people like Scott Belford are doing is invaluable. And what Lynn Spire and Novell are doing in Indiana is invaluable and really needs to be looked at as how to do it.
Yeah, and you know what? Well, you were just talking before about the OSDW, and a lot of these educational applications, I mean, you fire these things up, I see just basic KDE applications that look just as well, if not better, than those applications. I don't see why you actually couldn't have them port that stuff over to a cross-platform technology like Qt, which is
which application?
Anyone? Most of these educational applications that, I mean, they don't look any better than what's native in KDE right now. In fact, some of the KDE ones surpass these educational applications. Yep. I mean, they do a fantastic job. In conjunction with that, with the OSDW, are you seeing companies, commercial developers, starting to take hold and using the Qt libraries and really looking and saying, hey, we are not going to make this specific to Windows. We're going to make it so, yes, you know, our primary target right now is Windows, but it's going to be portable to Linux or FreeBSD or any other operating system. Is that momentum picking up, or is it still in the infancy stages?
Well, I think both. If Eric Eng, who is the fearless leader over at Trolltech, he gives a keynote pretty much every year at Academy, and they've been tracking this year. He showed the results of their survey from the last year. You know, what are their usages like? You know, what's, you know, how's it going for them? And the number of people that are using Qt is growing every year. I mean, they've got thousands and thousands of customers now, each with, you know, obviously multiple licenses. And when they say, well, are you making in-house applications or are you making, you know, applications to, you know, to sell out and, you know, into like an ISV would, or ship with a hardware or whatever, a remarkable number of products are actually being produced right now for not in-house consumption, but to actually be distributed outside. So, yeah, it's definitely happening. And I think it's both because the ISV market is large, and I think we've got a lot more growth to go, a lot more growth to go in general. So I think the trend line is great. We're moving in the right direction. Every year there are more people waking up and realizing this is the way to go. With OSDW, we actually have, you know, people that are, you know, coming out that, you know, they're coming out because their employer has sent them out, you know, to kind of learn what the heck is going on. Well, how do we do this? And, you know, we need to get at least, you know, some people on staff that have these basic ideas and basic skills, so that, you know, if this becomes the future, we actually know whether to gauge whether it is the future and whether we should actually start right now working on it. So, yeah, I mean, the trends, I think, are headed in the right direction. We've still got a long ways to go. Adobe just recently did a really great webinar. Hate that word, but it sounds like a marketing term. But they did a webinar for people in the open source community that was all about what it's like to be a large ISV developing with open source technology. Obviously reflecting their their experience with Adobe Acrobat Reader on Linux. And, you know, they point out a number of things they'd like to see a little bit different here and there. And, I mean, so we've got some things that we need to do as well. And a lot of that critique that we're getting back from ISVs, we're folding into what we're doing with KDE 4. And, you know, that virtuous cycle of get ISVs working, you know, with the tools that we work with and that we create, and they give us feedback, and then we go, oh, yeah, you know what, that's a really good idea. And they see, you know, response back. Much more responsive usually than they see with the, you know, other options out there. And that encourages them. And so we get more ISVs on board. And it's really the ability to bring these kind of companies into the community process, if not into the community directly. They may not open source their code, but we can at least bring them into the community process of feedback and support and, you know, and just generally growing that ecosystem that this platform relies on.
Yeah.
I have a KDE newbie question some people ask me, is why do all the applications in KDE have something with the K in it?
Why? Yeah, why did we name things with Ks? It started because it was a great way to namespace applications, right? We've got a word processor, K-words, the KDE word processor. And so, I mean, at a certain point, that scaled really well because, you know, we had, you know, a few dozen applications, and you could tell they're all KDE applications because they had the K in them, and that got kind of onerous. So people then started, you know, coming up with, you know, what's a word that's got a C in it, and then we'll change it to a K because that'd be really funny. And then that kind of got on, and we had a whole bunch of those. I don't know if you read Matthias Atish's blog at all. He's the guy who started KDE, actually, and he currently works at Trolltech. And his recently in his blog, a week ago, he went on about, you know, we need to change how we name our applications because we've grown out of that. And so, I mean, you look at, Plasma as an example, and Oxygen, which is our new visual theme, which includes icons and widgets, and not for KDE 4. And, you know, we're kind of moving away from, you know, the whole K this, K that.
I like one application I've really got into lately is DigiCam. That's fantastic. It's instead of opening up... Instead of using the GIMP to do just basic photo editing, lately I've been using DigiCam quite a bit.
Ah. And how do you find that?
It's great. I like it a lot. I like the red eye removal.
Yeah.
It's really quick and dirty and without a lot of overhead, you know?
Yeah. Well, it was one of the first applications that made it easy enough for, you know, your average person to plug their visual camera in and get it out and do stuff with it and tag things. Yeah, it's a great little app. I've been really, really happy to see during the KDE3 period how many really great quality applications have come out for KDE, but from the larger development community. Like DigiCam, you won't find a what we would traditionally term a core KDE developer involved in DigiCam like you would with, say, Conqueror or Contact or whatever. But it's an amazingly great application. Amarok is another one of those. You know, KPDF was resuscitated and made into something absolutely stellar by, you know, relative newcomers to the project when they started that, who are now doing all kinds of great things. It's cool to actually see the framework start to pay off by rippling out and creating these applications.
I mean, one of the strengths of KDE to me is that there's so many applications that come bundled with it. If you want to go on the other side and look at what are the weaknesses of KDE, one of the things that drives me crazy sometimes, it's the Arch server, the audio server, playing nicely with non-KDE applications.
Yeah, that, I wish I could say you're the only one. multimedia, someone in the channel actually, just before the show started, said that, if I remember correctly, said, I have a Mac laptop or a Mac system and a Linux system, and Linux isn't really friendly for multimedia. And I said, yeah, that's putting it lightly. Multimedia and Arts, you're talking about Arts, right? The multimedia layer?
The audio server.
Yeah. Okay. You just cut in and out a bit for me here, so just want to make sure I'm not talking about something completely random. Yeah, multimedia has been, you know, something that we've really struggled with for a number of reasons. You know, right from the hardware to what the kernel supported to we need codecs to we need some way to be able to multiplex applications and do mixing and do all these other things. And ARTS, when it emerged, was the only application of its type that filled that slot between kernel drivers and kernel systems and desktop applications. And a lot of people go, why can't you just use ALSA? And it's like, well, ALSA, that L is Linux. We actually want our applications to be portable. And at the time, ARTS made all kinds of sense because, well, there wasn't really anything else out there, and the aspiration was that it would, you know, people get interested in multimedia on open platforms. They join development in ARTS, and it would become more than just KDE. I mean, if you look at it now, ARTS actually has support for it has a glib aspect to it, so, you know, it's GTK friendly, a number of other things. But then a whole series of events occurred from the maintainer becoming really busy, not a lot of people getting interested in multimedia right at the time that we were. We were kind of ahead of that curve by a bit. And a few other things happening. Some weaknesses in the design of ARTS being kind of a first run at it started to emerge as we pressed it harder and harder. So at the time, I think it was the best decision we could make. Going to KDE4, we sat back and we decided, including with the ARTS maintainer, by the way, the guy who came up with it all, who's a brilliant guy and off doing other multimedia things on Linux now, that we need a new multimedia architecture laying underneath KDE. And on top of that, we're going to put a very, very thin, which means that it won't get in the way of, you know, in the terms of latency or memory overhead or whatever. That simplifies the multimedia layer for the average application. Most applications that deal with sound, they just want to play a sound, record a sound, stop a sound. You look at a jukebox player, that's all it does, right? It does, you know, it's a little bit of crossfading. It does a little, it doesn't do a whole lot of extraordinarily fancy things with audio. And those are what we consider audio applications for the consumer desktop, right? And once you start moving to things like GarageBand and OS X, you need a more complex API. But for the 95-98% case, we need a simpler API. So what we've decided to do is create a simple API and underneath that provide an actual multimedia engine. And that engine can be swapped out so that if we go to a platform that doesn't require such a thing, well, you can just use whatever's native. But if you're on a Linux or a Unix where we need that extra shim in there, you know, will we use GStreamer? Will we use, you know, NMM or MASS? Or we haven't, the multimedia people haven't decided that yet. They're actually writing suites of test programs to actually kind of put them to their paces, and they've been talking for quite some time with each of these projects, and there's been, you know, back and forth. I'm really happy with that because, A, it makes it a lot simpler to write applications that use audio in KDE. It also future-proofs it, so if we do have to do another switch out the bottom layer, most of our applications won't have to be touched code-wise because they'll be using that simplified layer on top of it, and it makes it more cross-platform because we don't need it, it's gone, and we'll have a more modern architecture underneath it on Linux, so we'll have, all in all, it's a kind of win-win-win. And again, this is just the maturation of the desktop, right? And going back to the question, is the Linux desktop ready? Well, it'll be ready for more people with every passing release. And for multimedia, I think KDE4 is going to be a pretty impressive release.
I'm looking forward to it myself. With bated breath.
Mm-hmm. What do you folks use for multimedia on Linux these days?
Mplayer, Zine.
Audacity.
Video LAN client.
Kino.
XMMS. OG123 or MPG123.
Someone on this line is like old school. Who is it that uses all the command line apps?
That's Dan.
I use hey, Dan. Command line apps all the time.
I love you, man. it's funny. I use a disturbing number of them as well. Just because I've been around it so long, it's like, yeah, so used to these programs. But Yeah, XML Mesh is one of the applications that I was glad to get rid of personally, actually. But yeah, MPlayer and Zine or Zine or however you say it. Yeah, I love those great projects. Wish they had better legal footing, but I think they're doing great things. It's non-trivial work.
Yeah, I have not really explored too much into the KDE side of audio multimedia. My wife uses KDE all the time. And mm-hmm. I think she uses MPlayer through or she might use, what's a KDE application, a video player? Is it
Caffeine? Okay, there's CamPlayer and there's Caffeine.
I think she's used Caffeine. You know, it always ends up being whatever opens the file for her, that's all that matters. She clicks on it
for most users.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, she.
Have you checked out Amarok at all?
Have I used it or has she used it?
Anybody. That's here.
I took a look at Amarok a few months ago, but that's a little heavier than what I use.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause part of my problem is I'm such a lazy bastard that if I'm actually up here using my computer, I'm not, you know, I have to unhook the audio cables over here and plug them in, or else I have to turn on the mixer and everything to get audio, and I'm just too damn lazy to do that.
We're all lazy.
So, you know, I don't use it. And then when I'm at work, I have to, I'm primarily an OS X, and, you know, I hate iTunes.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anything that starts
with... What would you hate it?
Huh?
What do you hate?
What do you hate about it?
DRM primarily.
What I just don't. I think if I want to listen to music, I just want to fire something up and play it. Video LAN client or XMMS runs perfectly for me. I don't need something to manage all my music for me. I know where it is. That's just me.
Video LAN client is great because it handles every freaking codec you can throw at it.
But it would be cool if. You know, I think, what is it, Magnatune? Isn't that integrating itself? Isn't that going to be integrated with Amarok?
Yes, it is.
So it's great that you now actually have a Linux solution for, you know, easy integration into an online music service.
Yeah, and you also got Elf Songs from Linspire, which is MP3 tunes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But when I want to watch my porn DVDs, I use Zine.
Yeah, see, actually, one of the things, DVDs, the one thing that I ran into it, and I'm kind of a combination between lazy bastard and just really don't have much time in general. I'm usually running at a million miles an hour. It's actually kind of nice to be sitting here and just chatting. But yeah, I played around for a while trying to, you know, install all the codecs and, you know, got, you know, Zine, you know, and MPlayer, both of them theoretically able to play DVDs. And neither of them did it the way I wanted it to. And, yeah, I was sitting there going, good grief, this is what we're giving users? This is ridiculous. So I grabbed Caffeine, just kind of, you know, see how much better this is. And actually did all whatever you're supposed to do in the command line and, you know, just did it. Did it right. And Zine, of course, could play DVDs, and Caffeine proved it could and had all the DVD menus and everything. And I hope it's not illegal in Canada because I'm admitting to having it. But, yeah, and it was actually one of those moments that went, wow, there's one less, you know, command line application that I will be using, just because the GUI did it better. And yeah, I think we can do that for a lot of people, you know, and a lot better than we're doing it now at times. Linus himself, you know, said that all the interesting stuff is going to be happening on the desktop, and I think he's very right.
So,
and I hope we see a lot more of the up and, you know, the newer developers moving that direction as well.
Saigo, hold on a second. I got to cut us off from BinRev, which is going to cut off, I guess, the majority of our listeners, because we only have till 10 o'clock, and it's 10 o'clock.
On BinRev.
So
hold on a second.
Bye, BinRev.
Bye, BinRev.
They're already gone. It's past 10 o'clock. So it's up to you whether you want to continue on. Really, because, I mean, you're talking about some interesting stuff. The unfortunate side is the live bin rev feed. We have to cut off at 10 o'clock. There are other mirrors, and we have to limit from our streaming server to 10 so that we don't get it doesn't interfere with the Skype or Asterix. If you have more to say, we usually carry on for another, as long as we want. We do have the files available for download. It's just that we are going to lose some listeners on the stream until they can either move to a mirror or whatever. So, like I said, we're not specifically cutting you off, but it's your choice how much longer you want to stay on.
Yeah. Well, actually, if that's about where the stream ends, I'll probably let you guys go. I've actually been watching the phone calls come in as we talked and just been ignoring them, and I probably have to return a few of them. So I actually probably will let you guys go. Thanks for having me on, though.
Anytime.
It was
thank
great.
Thank you for coming on. Thank you for the work that you're doing. It's fantastic.
Oh, thank you for appreciating that. That's cool.
I do have one question. How soon until we can start seeing some really cool screenshots of KDE4? Because I was looking over the website and your blog and everything, and I really didn't see many screenshots yet. Are they just not – are you not at that point yet, or are you just keeping those under wraps?
We just like teasing people. Well, one of the things – this is kind of an interesting little story – for a while, I was doing a lot of my brainstorming, my more interesting brainstorming, in public, on public lists. And I started watching various projects and closed source companies remarkably following up, a few weeks after I would say something with very similar messaging when they would, post a press release or what have you. So it was either a really interesting case of 100th monkey syndrome where, you think it and everyone's thinking it, or there was definitely some observation going on. And as I stopped doing that, I stopped finding my concepts and the concepts as well as the people I was working with appearing elsewhere. So that's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is for some of the look aspects, like the new Oxygen stuff we're working on, which we've got, I believe, three full-time artists working on right now. We're keeping that pretty much under wraps because we want it to look fresh when it emerges.
Uh-huh.
We don't want it to be, previewed now and then released in a year, and it goes, well, that was like last year's. We want it to have a bit of impact when we release it. Some of the final imaging you won't see for a bit yet, that's for sure. Some of the cool interaction stuff that we're doing, some of the cool graphics code, we're not going to hide our code. We're an open source project. There's no desire, no point to doing that. You're going to start to see this emerge. Right now we're doing the port to Qt 4, which is huge, and because we've got just a few million lines of source code to port over, and we're at the same time restructuring our library. So we've actually split our KDE libs into a snapshot that everyone else is developing against, and then a main line, which is being rapidly evolved into this new architecture that blog link I posted earlier of Daniel's that shows the layers. We're morphing it into that. That system, we're doing unit tests across everything, we're improving the documentation, it's a huge amount of work. And this is all foundational, and KDE really does have a history of foundational correctness. So we're doing those things. We've got a couple months worth of work. What I've been telling people with Plasma that are queued up to work on the various engines within Plasma, which is the layer right between the actual framework of Plasma and the stuff that you as a user will see. Our schedule is to start bringing those sub-projects online at the end of October, which means we'll start, and some of them are already starting to work on their core stuff, and then once the Plasma APIs are ready, they'll be able to just hook it all in. So in pretty rapid succession after October, we'll have language bindings. I don't know if you noticed, but in Plasma, we're going to be pushing JavaScript pretty heavy as a language to do applets in. So the engines will occur pretty quickly. We'll get language bindings. We've got people lined up for JavaScript, Python, Ruby, Java, etc. And at that point, we'll actually start to see iCandy on the desktop part of it emerge. And I assume it's going to be very similar kind of timelines for a lot of the other projects that come near end of year this year. We'll start to see some of the interaction and visual elements, appear in our subversion repository in a form that, you know, you can kind of look at and poke at and watch it crash and laugh. And it probably won't be until the spring when we start to see some really, really polished stuff. And then as we move closer to actual release, we'll start putting in the artwork that we've been working on quietly, and the new theming and some of the new graphical effects and whatnot, right in there, and we'll start previewing those at that point. So unfortunately to say, some of the really cool stuff is going to be a little bit off, but we're going to start to see these things emerge for the people that love to be on the bleeding edge and keep up with absolutely everything that's going on, probably November-ish.
Cool.
Yeah.
We'll have to talk. We'll have to talk again.
So what's that?
You'll have to come on again before then.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch a thing you said there. It broke up pretty bad.
He said you'll have to come on again before then.
Oh, yeah. I would love to. That would be great. It's actually kind of a nice show. It's kind of free flowing and free form, and not quite as high pressure as some of the other ones I've been on. Yeah, so no, it's been fun. I'd love to be back. Love to be back.
Well, we're glad that you came on and you've been reading your blog, and we actually I saw that last week you said that you were going to be on our show, and you know that made it all more exciting for us to have you on to see that you were actually looking forward to it, and you know, keep up the great work.
Yeah.
I really, really, really appreciate you talking to us.
No, it's cool. All right, well, you guys take care, and I'll see you guys online.
Take care.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Woo, Pat, you will get a happy phone bill.
That's okay. It's not that expensive.
Taking one for the cause.
No, we got an hour. We went slightly over.
Speaking of taking one for the cause, we got 3 more gigs on the server.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So
now, that means we could keep three, sir?
For now, yes.
Back to Link.
Is anybody in here?
Link, are you there?
Is there anybody?
Uh-oh. Oh, shit. Are we still recording or no?
We're recording on the MP3. Oh, crap.
You dead in the water there?
No. Oh,
what'd you do?
Man.
You pulled the power cord out?
I never plugged it in.
The AUG?
That was the AUG. Shit.
Well, hopefully the MP3 is a decent quality today.
Oh, wait.
Hello.
Hey, what's up, Link?
Not much. How you guys doing?
Dan,
took me a second to get back on because I was listening to the actual broadcast, which is like 2 minutes behind what you guys are actually doing. So
Dan just had a major clusterfuck.
Oh, wait.
No, not Dan.
He never hooked up the cable going to the AUG recording. So,
no way.
Could you turn down your volume?
So we'll have MP3 tonight, huh?
You're really distorting. Like, could you turn your mic down a little bit?
Sure. How about that?
That's better.
Okay.
Yeah, so it looks like the AUG's going to be coming from the MP3 tonight.
That's all right. There's nothing wrong with that.
Dan turned white right here. He's just like stunned. And, too much overload for Dan to handle in one session.
Man.
See, you know, what we really have to do is we all have to get together and we have to set some more or some different machines up there. And
yep, break up.
We need donations from our listeners. What we really need is we need one machine. We need, like, little rack mount cases, right? So any of you guys that got some leftover rack mount cases, we need to have them. Dan's got a 19-inch rack. And what we need is a rack mount case for or including a PC to do Skype. Another one to do the Asterisk server. And one to run Dynabolic on so that we can actually do the show. And then we'll be in really good shape.
We can use
He's only like two computers short now, but we just have to get them all there. And you know Dan's not going to do it because he's a freaking procrastinator. So we're going to have to come there one weekend and hijack his shit for him.
Clean all the stuff out. Throw it in the garbage.
Yep. Right, Dan?
Yeah.
He's pissed off.
Oh, man.
He's pissed out, man.
Oh. It's good. At least we have the MP3 going now.
Shit happens, you know.
I cannot believe that I lost the entire everything I had through Audacity is gone.
Diog.
What was going to be Diog is gone. Well,
I wish I had had a little forethought. I could have, you know, recorded it as we were going over here. You know, hindsight is 20/20, I guess.
You know what? I sat here and I turned this thing on. I'm like, I'll plug it in a little bit. And I can't believe that it went through the entire, like, 2 hours without needing to be plugged in. 2.5 hours almost. And I mean, it was doing a lot of stuff.
So, you just recorded a flat line through Audacity?
Huh? No, this...
You just recorded...
See, this is really stupid of me. This is... On my old laptop... On my old laptop, I had my home directory separate from the file system, and I didn't have enough space to record the file on the file system on my home directory, so I set it up that it was recording through Audacity and dumping it into temp, and I never changed that.
That's right. So anytime it crapped out, you could still get it from the temp directory, right?
Well, but when the machine went down like this and I brought it back up, it deletes everything in the temp directory. So I...
Dumbass.
Yeah, it's really stupid. And I got to change that from now on. You know, two things conspired against me there. I knew I should not have... I should have plugged this in immediately instead of going to do something else. And secondly, I should change that to go back now to my home directory since I have gobs of disk space. Instead of going into temp, at least I would have had... the Audacity files I could have pieced back together by hand. But the only thing we lost was the pre-show stuff, which there wasn't much going on. It was just a bunch of bullcrap. So there's not going to be an extra special aug this time.
No big deal.
And it's been recording over here for the MP3. So I'll just have to...
There really wasn't much pre-show.
Yeah, you know what we need to do,
today,
man? Dan does everything, pretty much. I think what we need to do is figure out a way to break it up so that he isn't like the one person that's doing everything.
The one point of failure.
Because you get overloaded, man. You know, you got the stream going. You're connecting to BinRev and the other streams. You're recording the MP3. You're recording the AUG. You got the Asterisk server going. You know, you got the X-Lite client going. You got Skype going. It gets a little crazy sometimes.
What makes it easier, and I blame Lincoln Allen for this, is if more people are here. Because when it's just you here and you stop talking, then I gotta jump in and talk, or because we gotta keep it going. And if I'm in the middle of doing something, it's hard for me to pay attention to you or whoever the guest is and keep track of some of this other stuff and start everything on time because we don't have another person here to bounce off stuff off of. So it's Lincoln Allen's fault.
Yeah, I'm not sitting in front of you going. I'm not sitting in front of you going, did you start the recording? Did you shut the music off, Dan? Like I usually do.
He hasn't been doing the music.
Did you turn the music off, Dan?
You haven't been doing the music ever, okay?
No, I don't do music. We don't do it because I record the pre-show stuff, so that goes out, you know, usually goes out live.
Well, like I said, if we got some if we got some different equipment and rack-mounted some actual equipment over there and your nice rack that I gave you, then... You know, we could do things a little bit differently, and perhaps, you know, Alan and I could keep track of, keep track of the Skype stuff or keep track of the Asterisk stuff while the show was going.
One of the problems that I'm looking at here with regards to that is I thought about this. If we had another machine that we could run, like, Skype off of, we could have connected it. I was thinking about how we could have connected it so that you could be on Skype and on the Asterisk, and the people on Skype could hear what's going on the Asterisk and vice versa. You
need a bigger mixer then.
Yeah, but then we run out of ports on the mixer.
Well, you know, I have two other mixers over here, and we have the old mixer still, too. So we have plenty of mixers. We just have to get the computers together and do it instead of wrapping wires all around your office like we've been doing.
Right. But I don't... Then we're going to risk blowing a circuit, too, on top of it with all the extra systems in play.
I think we need a new studio, though.
A new studio.
I got to finish my basement, and we'll build the studio down there.
Yeah. Well, anything else you'd like to add, Link, while you have the floor and I...
That's it, pretty much. I was just going to talk about that the eye candy stuff that I put on, but, you know, pretty much I put some of my comprehensive notes, I guess, on there, and people can look it up.
You want to save that till next week?
And get the... Well, they can get the IP address or the address off of the chat log and check it out, and that covers most of it right there.
Did you guys check out my blog about I had my little conversation with the people at HP?
Yes, and I thought that was really great posting. It's too bad you didn't audio record that conversation.
I was on there. I was looking at the website, and they were offering this one machine for like $599. It's like a low-end laptop, and I read that article about them offering Ubuntu only in South Africa. So I was like, you know, I'm on there, and all of a sudden I get a pop-up saying, "Do you want to chat?" So I'm like, "Yeah, I'll chat." And they start chatting, and you can see my chat log that I posted on my blog. And then they're, you know, they kept transferring it to different sales reps because I don't think any of them knew what the hell I was talking about. So finally, they call me on the phone. The lady I was talking to, she was very nice, the one at the end. She got this guy on the phone. And basically, he was like, "Well, we recommend Windows." I'm like, "I don't want Windows. I want Linux." You know, I'm like, "Not for nothing. If you guys offered a Linux either pre-install or an ISO image available for download, a lot of people would buy your machines, you know, if they knew that all the hardware was supported right out of the box, you know, wireless, you know, sleep mode, whatever." And, you know, I was
sure.
I was kind of met with blank stares and, you know, silence on the phone, you know.
You know what the funniest part was? I was reading through your chat log that you captured, and I kept thinking to myself, is this, are there real people at the end of this chat log, or is it like a computer-generated sort of thing?
There were real people.
You know, because that's almost what it sounded like to me. It was like they didn't understand your question. You were asking perfectly legitimate questions, and they just had no answer whatsoever. So I was kind of wondering if it was just the same kind of bookish answer. I was wondering if they were just computer-generated chats.
No, they were real people. I was actually surprised. When I picked up the phone, I was expecting to hear an Indian accent on the other end. And surprisingly, no. They sounded like either they're Americans or Canadians. Very neutral.
Yeah.
Sound.
Yeah, guys,
we need
you guys ever remember that program called
Linux.
Eliza? Right.
Yeah.
You guys remember that program called Eliza?
That
it's a fake chat program. No, it's a fake chat program I used to run a long, long time ago, years and years ago on BBSs. And it was just a fake chat, like an AI personality. And you could talk to it. And that's sort of the feel that I got while you were chatting with the people at HP.
This was a real deal.
Kind of an Eliza program. There wasn't really anybody there.
There were definitely real people. Surprisingly.
Go figure, huh?
Boy, that doesn't say much for them, huh?
No, they're really in bad shape in Europe, especially. They're laying off like thousands of people, supposedly.
Hooray.
I guess we're going to wrap it up.
In just a minute. Hey,
Wow. Hey, Judy just got on the IRC chat, Pat, and says that he found a couple of Ahoy magazines the other day and looked up your brother's name and saw he was an editor.
Yeah, hey, my brother, way back in the day, used to do Ahoy magazine, which was Commodore 64. And then
Right. Then
after that, he started doing video games. He worked for Larry Flynn Publications in L.A. for about 5 or 6 years. And then he was based in Connecticut for a while. Now he's looking for a job. My brother.
Well, you can tell him, since he's got that free time, he can help us get our TLLTS magazine together, right?
You know, my brother's a very weird guy. I try to talk to him about, like, Linux, and just try to talk to him about it. He is, like, so resistant to it. It's sickening.
Who, your brother?
Yeah, my brother. He's very stubborn.
About Windows?
Yeah, he's into gaming, and he's into PC gaming, big time.
Well, then you should encourage him to use Windows then, because that'll make his transition to Linux eventually that much more better, because he will know for sure that Linux is better than Windows. You know,
I gave the example, I don't know, about a month ago when I was over at my dad's and my brother was there. And it was a fairly new Dell machine. It was just loaded. He finally got a DSL connection. Okay, he didn't have a firewall running, you know, or a hardware firewall, but he had, like, Norton antivirus running, and he was just loaded with spyware. The machine was running so slow. It was like a 2.8 gigahertz Dell. I popped in the Canonic CD, the bootable, and it was just smokingly fast compared to Windows. And I showed him this, and he just wasn't getting it, I guess. You know, I'm like, you know, I was like trying to tell him, you know, let's wipe this out, man, and put freaking Linux on it. Oh, no. I want to play my games, you know. But whatever.
Full boot.
Just some good news for you, Link. I know you're excited to hear this. The Linux show is supposedly coming back.
Yay!
Hi from atop an undisclosed location
secret
in
location.
Chicago. They will be broadcasting very shortly, and potentially both audio and video.
Good for them.
Wow, that is exciting. And I might add, that's also something that I've heard over and over and over again.
What are you trying to say, Link? Don't hold your breath.
That's what I'm trying to say. I want to. Not only do I want to hear the first show, but I want to hear like the 10th show. And we'll decide from there, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Let's wait and see.
But hey, more power to them if they want to get stuff back together and going on. There's always room for more Linux goodness out on the virtual airwaves, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely.
Even if they were not entirely cooperative with us, that doesn't mean that we can't be big and be cooperative with them. So
exactly.
By all means.
Let's take the high road.
Yeah.
And we should probably not only cut off, but also take that high road with other Linux shows that we've been bashing, too, quite frequently.
Have we got any response back about that?
No. But I would like to say, if he does listen, yes, Adrian.
Hi, this is Alessandra. Please give a message.
What the hell was that?
I don't know. Yes.
To leave your callback number, press 5.
What the hell is that, man?
I have no idea. But I would like to say, Adrian, if you are listening, yes, we would love to hear your opinion on SCO and IP and everything. But I'll just leave it at that. Because I would. I listen to Linux Log every week.
I don't.
I do.
I got tired of it.
I listen occasionally.
And we also can't leave without mentioning that, yes, Slackware 10.2 is just on the verge of... is it already out?
I don't think
so. Is the final out?
No, not yet. No.
But it's going to be released any day now.
We're going to play some music going out?
Oh, yeah.
Play some music, man.
Forgot about the music.
We're
going to
play a band called Cell Dweller, which is this band...
Cellar Dweller.
Cell Dweller. Just Cell. They're from New York, and they're on an independent label. It's not Creative Commons, but I contacted the record company, and they gave us permission to play any of the tracks on the album as much as we'd like. So I think we're going to play this one called I Believe You.
We'll just play them both. We got plenty of time.
Play them both. Two songs, back to back. Cell Dweller. Very Nine Inch Nails is kind of music. It's real good. I like it. Fire it up, and let's go. Play I Believe You.
All right, guys. Good night.
Good night, Link. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Ooh,
I guess next week we'll touch base with the Fluxbox and Enlightenment DR17 stuff.
Have a guest for next week, too.
Yeah, and we have a guest, so. And no problems with the org, I hope.
Hopefully.
I'm nervous now about the MP3.
We'll find out.
All right, we're going to play stuff out of here. Here we go.
Cell Dweller,
I Believe You, and then followed by Switchback, and then the closing crap. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. have not eaten for days.
And who says you will?
Give me food, so I have strength when the wolves come. Let me die not in hunger, but in combat.
Who are you?
I am Subutai, thief and archer. I am Harkonnen, the great order of Kurlet.
So what are you doing here?
Dinner for wolves.
Were you making a poo young in the kitchen? Or I was in the dining room having sushi.